Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. I live in Kansas City, and there are a lot of estate sales in my neighborhood. If you've never been to one, this is where someone is liquidating, well, most of their life. They have decades of accumulated things and they're downsizing. And you see a person having to decide what in their life to keep and what to throw away. There are some things that are really significant. If you have the Congressional Medal of Honor, you're probably keeping that. If you have a bank receipt from the 1980s, you're throwing it away. But in the middle, there's a massive gray area where you can't figure out if it is or is not worth keeping. That's just on the personal level, but if you expand that out to the national level, there are people who work in a field called cultural resource management, basically archaeologists, who have to decide if something is worth keeping or not keeping as part of a nation's history. Our guest today is Chris Webster. Chris is an archaeologist who does the same thing. If you want to figure out if a building belongs on the National Register of Historic Places, you call in Chris, and he'll use different high-tech tools to determine, according to different data points, if something is historic. He's looked at everything from old mining towns in Nevada, hotels from the 1930s, Spanish missions, and even found Neolithic burial sites. So I ask him right up front if he's being haunted by unspeakable ancient evil all the time, and fortunately his answer is no, spoiler alert. Chris is also a very prolific podcaster. He runs the Archaeology Podcast Network and helps produce Archaeological Fantasies, The Archaeological Show, and Arc 365, an archaeology podcast that comes out once every day. Enjoy this discussion about what it means to preserve a nation's past with Chris Webster. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
I read an article in The Onion a few years ago that said, archaeologists tired of unearthing unspeakable ancient evil, where you're trying to ask this ghost about pottery and that keeps shouting curses at you in Sumerian. So how many times have you had that happen in your career?
Only a handful of times, Scott. But that's why we carry crosses and garlic with us. So, you know, I think one of the great things about archaeology is we get to dispel those types of rumors. It's not Indiana Jones and whips and curses.
So specifically, you do cultural resource management, which I've met archaeologists, but to be honest, I didn't know the term CRM before. So Is there a difference between CRM and archaeology? Is it a branch of archaeology or something else?
Right. Well, we typically sort of erroneously refer to CRM archaeology, for example, like a type of archaeology. But realistically, cultural resource management is in the broader context of the term. It's the, well, I mean, quite frankly, it's the management of cultural resources. And that could mean anything from environmental concerns to preservation techniques to anything like, for example, placing something on the National Register of Historic Places is a form of cultural resource management. Turning something into a park or a museum or something like that is cultural resource management. CRM archaeology is basically using archaeology as a tool under cultural resource management to manage cultural resources. And that's what it's kind of a circular reasoning and definition there. But that's basically what it is. Like as a company owner, if I'm tasked to go in and let's say, you know, survey a property or something like that for a developer. That's cultural resource management. Now, part of what I'm going to do is I'm actually just going to do what we call a pedestrian survey out here in Nevada. I'm going to walk over the land with my crew. We're going to record anything that's over 50 years old because that's the rule. Record anything that's over 50 years old. And then that is kind of archaeology to me. It's really more just survey, just a cultural survey. So I still consider that basically just CRM. Now, if we come back, if we found something amazing and the developer says, okay, but I still need to put a building there or I need to put a highway there and I can't move it, I can't do anything else, then we have to come back and excavate it. That's the archaeology part of CRM archaeology. But we tend to call all of it CRM archaeology. However, if they said, yeah, we can move this, we just need to avoid it. You know, we're putting in a pipeline and we can just drag it this way a couple hundred meters and avoid that site. That's also cultural resources management because we're managing the resource by avoiding the resource. We're alerting the developer to its presence and we're avoiding it. Or, you know, in some really extreme cases, and this happens on the East Coast a lot, you have some really buried, deeply buried archaic sites or something like that, because there's a lot of soil development on the East Coast, unlike the West Coast where everything's sitting on the surface, or at least in the desert. On the East Coast, it's all sand. You can have a hurricane dump several feet of sand in one episode, and then everything's buried, right? So a lot of times, they just, for a footprint or a foundation of a building, they only need to go down 4 or 5 feet. So if they don't hit the cultural level that's important, preserving that cultural resources could actually be putting a building on top of it. It's a weird way to look at it, but it actually does preserve it intact, in situ, we call it. It's untouched, it's unexcavated, because excavation is destruction. When we excavate stuff, we destroy it. So by putting a slab of concrete and a building over it, you're actually preserving it. Now, of course, you run the danger of, in 50 years when they tear that building down, is anyone going to know there's still a site underneath there, or are they just going to dig right through it? Hopefully they'll have similar laws in place where they'll have to, you know, research what's underneath there and know that. So that's a long way to say cultural resource management is really just taking care of cultural resources in any way that we possibly can. And archaeology is one tool of that.
I think it would surprise people when they hear about archaeologists in the United States, because they get that with Pompeii, the Roman Empire, ancient Greece, yada, yada. Of sites thousands of years old, but in America they think, well, if anything were of important cultural significance, it would have just been preserved from when it was built until now. So what kind of archaeology are you doing in the United States? What sort of things do you find and preserve?
Well, the specific letter of the law is anything that is over 50 years old. And that's from the, there's a line in the National NHPA, National Historic Preservation Act, that basically alludes to that. But then there's other rules within various agencies. And like I said, anything over 50 years old. So right now in 2017, that's anything older than 1967. We record all of that stuff. And that's how we decide. We don't have any sort of bias against it. We don't say anything. We look at something, and if we can date it, if we can date the site via maker's marks or some sort of manufacturing technique or something like that, or actual documents or something, and it's older than 50 years, then we record it without any sort of prejudice or bias or interpretation. So, and that's a lot of what we do here in the United States is I try to tell my people that when I have crews, I try to say, listen, it's not really our job to decide or interpret anything about this site. I mean, we can give our thoughts when we record it, but our job is to just record the data. So we have the data before it is destroyed by a development project. So we have the data to go back to in 5 months or 5 years or 50 years when somebody looks at the data again and says, okay, I'm going to take your raw data, I'm going to analyze it, and I'm going to see what you guys found and then come up with these conclusions based on new information or something like that. So that's basically what we do. And it's funny when you talk to people about archaeology and they don't think about archaeologists in the United States, but there's around, depending on who you talk to, you know, 10 to 12,000 practicing professional archaeologists in the United States, and only a fraction of those are actually working at universities and doing what people typically think of as archaeology, which is the Indiana Jones professor tweed jacket, you know, and then in the summer they go out and run around, you know, ancient sites and invoke unspeakable terrors and curses. And that's just simply not the case. Most archaeologists are not university professors. Most archaeologists have a bachelor's degree, no graduate degree, and they're field technicians out in the field doing actual archaeology every single day as a living. So
the fastest way also to annoy an archaeologist is to ask what it's like to dig up dinosaur bones. So
my God. And that is, I actually love getting that question. I used to hate it because of the ignorance, but I love getting it because it's a teaching moment, right? The teaching opportunity. I was like, well, dinosaurs is about 65 million years too early for what I study. I was like, and then you get to say, well, that's paleontology. Okay. So paleontology. And then archaeo is Greek for human. Archaeology, the study of humans. So yes, we do get that a lot. Yeah.
I like to think of the past logarithmically. The farther back you go, it just, you know, whatever blends together.
Nice. It's all just history to you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Just in the past. There it is.
That's right.
So what does it look like for you or other archaeologists that you've looked with that anything 50 years or older, that's a pretty, you know, broad swath, but what type of things do people preserve? Is it, I mean, in my imagination immediately goes to a colonial building or some notable's house, but does this also cover American Indian artifacts or other things like that?
That's a good question. There's actually really strict definitions for what we preserve. But then there's also personal and cultural preference. So I'll start with the really strict definitions. In the National Park Service outlays, because they're the ones that maintain the National Register of Historic Places, and really all we're doing when we go out is we're evaluating properties for eligibility to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. That's technically what we're doing, okay? So when we look at a property, and by property, I just mean archaeological site or whatever, we try to answer one of four questions. Is it an in-person, was it an important event take place there? And that event doesn't even have to be 50 years old. Like the 9/11 site is on the National Register of Historic Places because it was a culturally significant event. It doesn't need to be 50 years old to be placed on the National Register. It's instantly significant. For example, if we had a president that was less than 50 years old, their birthplace is automatically on the National Register of Historic Places, like the home that they grew up in. I mean, we always preserve those sorts of things, but because they're the president, it's an important person, which is the next criteria. Is the site associated with an important figure in history if it's of regional significance, then it'll probably go on the state register. If it's of national significance, then it will go on the National Register. And then does the construction method represent, they call it the work of a master. And this can be, it's often interpreted as just architecture, like did a famous architect develop this, or was it a really unique piece of architecture that nobody's ever seen before? Like, is there only one example of it in the world or a handful of them, and it's really special? But it can also represent objects. Like, is it an object that's the work of a master, like a painting or something like that could be considered. But you can't put a painting on the National Register of Historic Places, but that object in that location would make that location significant. And then the final criteria is data potential. And this is where a lot of Native American sites come in, is there a significant data potential at this site? Like, we're not going to go in there and spend $400,000 and excavate the whole thing, but the survey that we've done and the initial examination we've done says that there's probably a lot more here and a lot more that we can learn about this area and about these people. But nobody's going to pay to dig it up right now. So because of its data potential, we're going to get it listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the NRHP. And by listing it on the NRHP, it affords it some protections from development and from future activities. That doesn't mean somebody can't come in and dig it up, but it's going to be a lot more difficult to do that. Now, those are the strict criteria for what we decide to preserve. The other way is, it's basically personal preference. I mean, if you as a person, like your grandfather's house or something like that, your grandfather's property or something is really, really important to you and maybe really important to the regional area. Maybe like my in-laws, my wife's grandparents, actually, I think their grandparents even or their parents. So her great grandparents started this resort up in New York State, and people go there every summer. There's cabins. Her dad grew up there. Kind of running the resort, and now her uncle runs the resort with his kids. And this resort is not of national significance, but it's definitely of regional significance. I mean, it takes up half of this lake in this area. And my thinking is, if somebody wanted to place that resort on the National Register, at least on the State Register of Historic Places, they could probably get that listed, but no one is going to pay to probably have that done. It would probably be the locals, the family, or something that said, listen, we think this is significant, and we want to prevent a developer from coming in here, mowing down all the condos and putting up, or all the cabins and putting up a condo high rises or multi-million dollar properties around this lake. We want to prevent that. So we're going to have our place listed on the State Register of Historic Places. So like I said, we have very strict definitions that we go by, and then individuals can have personal reasons for trying to do something. But again, you're not going to get these protections unless you can prove significance to everybody, not just yourself, or at least to the region.
That has to be really challenging in some instances to decide, let's keep this and let's not. It seems like writ large, going through family memorabilia and thinking, okay, this receipt from the 1970s doesn't matter. Now this, I don't know, letter from Woodrow Wilson. Yeah, that's important. But then there's that gray area in the middle. I know it's not only up to you, but how do you do that? Like, could you give some examples of things where you had to determine, okay, this is significant, but this isn't significant?
Right. It's really difficult. It's really, really difficult. It's when it comes down to historic sites, it's relatively simple. And for the audience, what we mean by historic sites is really anything that's not prehistoric. So if it's, you know, like early mining, early settlement, cultural, something like that, European based, that's all historic. prehistoric, by definition, is typically, they say pre-European contact, but it's really solely Native American. But that's not, okay, there's one in the middle too called ethnohistoric, which is Native American that has been in contact with Europeans and their culture has been influenced. So if you see a Native American culture and they're making projectile points or arrowheads out of glass, or they have, you know, silverware, or they have things that they've traded for with the Europeans, that now becomes ethnohistoric, they call it. So when we see one of these sites, like a historic site, it becomes a relatively simple exercise to answer one of those four questions. Like, we see a lot of early mining sites from the late 1800s and early 1900s here in Nevada. And we can tell pretty quickly just by looking at it, you know, was this a significant mine? Was it significant for the area? We could tell, because if it only has, say, a mine shaft or, you know, maybe some small artifacts and things like that, some trash left behind, it's going to be a run-of-the-mill operation. Somebody just set it up, blah, blah, blah. But if it's got, you know, 16 building foundations, a bunch of shafts, some head frames, a whole bunch of stuff going on, then this mine was relatively successful, brought in a lot of stuff, and it was probably significant for the area. So we might recommend that based on that. You'd have to go down. Now, sometimes we'll recommend stuff. We'll take the easy way out and we'll recommend stuff as potentially eligible. So we won't say it's eligible for listing, but we'll say some more research needs to be done, because we can't actually make a determination. We know it's not ineligible, but we don't know if it's actually eligible. And one of the reasons we would say that for historic sites is, unless you go do the background research in the records and archives and things like that, it's very possible that something could have been owned by somebody important for the region. It could have been owned by a future governor or a future senator, or, you know, somebody who was important for the area. This could have been their mine. This could have been their house. This could have been their homestead or something like that. So we don't know that when we're in the field. We have to do that later. So we'll say it's potentially eligible. There's a lot of stuff here and it could be important, but we're not sure. So we'll say that. With prehistoric stuff, we almost never know whether or not it was a particular group of people. I mean, sometimes we can kind of say that because based on where we're at, but we'll never know if it's an important person that's associated with it, because they just didn't have written records of that stuff and people didn't have like signed objects. We'll never know if it was an important event. We'll know if it's an important event if somebody wrote about it. Like, I just did a podcast earlier about this battle that took place between Native Americans and the U.S. Army in 1865. And that site where that battle took place is on the National Register of Historic Places. It's in Nebraska. And but that's on the Register of Historic Places because it was an interaction between Native Americans and U.S. Army. I guarantee you, if Native Americans had been fighting other Native Americans, we'd never know about it. like we wouldn't know the history of that battle. But because somebody wrote about it later on, it's in U.S. Army diaries and the logs that they kept as military people, then we know about it. And so we can do that. But purely Native American sites, they're probably not going to be listed because of those reasons. Now, what we almost always list a Native American site as is for the data potential, the last one, Criterion D, they call it. Because if we find a whole bunch of stuff on the surface, we find a whole bunch of tools or maybe evidence of long-term habitation or something like that, we usually don't have a permit to excavate down over here on the West Coast until we come back with a permit that says you can excavate. But that's a different phase of the project. We'd have to tell our developer and the lead agency, listen, we found some stuff here and we think it's important, so you're going to have to avoid it or dig it up. And that means it's potentially eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion D. It wouldn't be eligible until we actually excavated it, which is the catch-22. Because once we excavate it, now there's nothing eligible there because we took it all away. So it's a weird thing. Most Native American sites end up becoming potentially eligible and just avoided and never go to the eligible state, because the process of finding out whether or not it's eligible actually destroys it.
Yeah, that is tricky, huh?
Yeah.
Are there any particular properties that stick out in your mind of favorite places that you found that were way more than you thought they would have been at the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely. One of them is the very first, the very second project I ever worked on. It's a weird way to say that. The second project I ever worked on was in downtown Miami, Florida. It was called the, we called it 1AMD. That was the designation from the state for the site. But it was across the river, the Miami River, from a site called the Miami Circle. And anybody listening to this can just go ahead and Google the Miami Circle. I don't know if you have show notes, you can put a link to something, because it's an amazing thing. The Miami Circle was found, I want to say, in the 90s, late 90s, by the same company that we ended up working for on the other side of the river. But basically, it was a series of holes, basically carved using conch shells into the limestone bedrock. And it was, nobody knew what these holes were for initially until they started actually kind of doing a little more research, uncovered them. Then they started noticing it was roughly a circular shape. And the hypothesis is, based on some ethnohistoric information too, and that just means probably Spanish, you know, conquistadors coming through and visually recording what they see from the Native Americans that were living there and their practices. It sounds like what they used to do is they would take their dead. Sometimes they would just live in these huts that were suspended up over the limestone. That's what these poles were for. They were for posts. But a lot of times they would take their dead and put them in these structures or just on these wooden platforms they would make. And their dead would sit there for months at a time until the bones were completely desiccated. They were picked apart by animals, whatever. They would just let nature take its course. And they would gather up these bones, float across the Miami River to the north, and the well, we called it, where we were digging, they would dump them into these limestone solution holes. So we started digging down in this historic well that started out historic, because actually, you know, you go further back in time as you start from the top, obviously. So we were encountering stuff from a hotel that was there in the 1930s. Then we were encountering stuff from a Spanish fort that was there, I think, in the 1840s. And before the Spanish fort was a Spanish mission that was there in the early 1800s. And then from then down, it was all Native American stuff going back 10,000 years. Wow. And we would keep just digging down, and we'd get down, you know, meters below the surface, and we'd find another, you know, it was kind of a, this well was, I'm using my hands, even though this is an audio podcast. This well was kind of concave, like you would imagine a well would be. It was a natural well that the Spanish actually kind of excavated a little bit. But in the natural sort of area of it, it was a fresh water source, and it was also ritualistic, but they would still dump bodies into this weird fresh water source. It was strange. But anyway, we would find these what we call disarticulated skeletons. So not a skeleton that's all laid out with the bones attached to each other, just a pile of human remains in this big limestone solution hole. And we'd have to pull this stuff out one by one. And there's now a high-rise condo over the top of it. But I've heard, I haven't been there since then, but I've heard there is almost a kind of a small museum to the Tequesta Indians who were there and the history of the place. So actually in the condo that's there now, there's in the bottom floor, I've heard, I haven't been there before since they put the condo up, but there's like a museum to the history of the Tequesta Indians. Not really a museum, more of a displays from what I understand, like acknowledging. This is almost like an episode, like a movie, like The Poltergeist or something like that. I mean, this condo is literally built on an Indian burial ground. So I'm not really sure how the residents and people feel about that, but it's, yeah, built on an Indian burial ground. Some of the stuff out here in the West that we found, I mean, sometimes it's amazing when you're out walking in the high desert and you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere and nobody's ever been here. And then you come up over a hill onto an old mining town or an old mining complex that's completely deserted. And it's just sometimes there's buildings. A lot of times there's no buildings left because resources were scarce back then. And if something was abandoned, they'd often take all the wood with them, or somebody would find the wood from a structure and they would go, you know, take all that wood and build other structures somewhere else. Or sometimes these little buildings were just wholesale picked up, put on rollers and dragged away by horses. Because it was easier than finding more trees and building more things and milling the wood and doing the stuff. So, but we find the platforms where the structures were. And sometimes that stuff's a little hard to see. So you're coming up on it on survey and you start looking in the landscape and into the distance, that hill just looks a little bit strange, or it just looks a little bit different. And you get up on it and you start looking, and it's all these like what we call cut and fill structures. Like if you're going to build a house on an angle, you'll cut away from the hillside and take that material and use it to flatten out a section. So it's called cut and fill. And then they'll build the structure on that flat surface. But over the course of 100 years, erosion has kind of softened the corners and things, and it doesn't look as striking until you get right up on it. Then you start seeing glass fragments, nails, cans, all kinds of stuff. And it's really amazing what's out in the desert, actually. Another thing we found one time was an old 1930s box freezer section of an old ice cream truck that still had like the paint on it from the ice cream truck. And we think it was used. It was on a hillside away from a large mining complex, and we think it was used to store explosives.
Really? So, in an ice cream truck, what would make that good for storing explosives?
I think it was just the insulation. I think they thought that the insulation would help it from keep it from getting super hot in the summertime, probably. And because this is just dynamite, it was really primitive explosives. I mean, it's just dynamite. It could be set off if it gets too hot in there, probably. And maybe they thought the insulation would contain an explosion, maybe. I mean, it wouldn't have, not at all, not with that level of explosives in there. But it's just its location and how it was sitting there. That was our conclusion. We actually had no proof. There was nothing left of it. No explosives in there. It was just the box truck with, like, and it wasn't even the truck. It was just the box portion set on the ground with dirt built up around it. And you could open the door and go inside. And yeah, there was no rhyme or reason to it. Explosives was the only thing we could come up with. And I don't even know if we were right or not.
I'm glad no one got hurt, because how embarrassing would it be on your obituary? I died in an ice cream truck explosion.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I'd actually want that on my tombstone. Died in an ice cream truck explosion.
One other thing you mentioned with the Miami Circle, I'd like to back up, because this is a fascinating aspect of archaeology to me. You mentioned finding human remains, and I don't know if you specifically work with this, but if you don't, for others who do work with this, what about human remains and what they tell us about the past? One of my archaeology friends who was on a fellowship, he worked in Mesopotamia about 2000 BC in the Bronze Age, and almost all his data came from drilling teeth. And he found incredible troves of information on people's diets, how old they were, what the climate was based on their nutrition. So what can human remains tell us about the past?
Human remains can tell us a lot. Just taking the remains themselves, you can tell a lot about an individual. And somewhat about their environment and about what they did. For example, your bones, when you're using your muscles and you're doing different things and you're doing different activities throughout the day, scientists and osteology is the study of human bones. So that's the people that do that. You can have archaeoosteologists and things like that that specifically study ancient human remains. And they have studies based on modern populations. Like when somebody dies and donates their body to science, which is why everyone should do this. They'll have all the information about you. They'll know that, you know, let's say you were a carpenter or something like that, and you spent a lot of time on your knees and doing different things. Your knees, your bones and your legs will display that. They'll say, okay, so this person spent a lot of time doing this type of work. What do their bones look like? Because your muscles will pull on your bones and develop different things and then have that visual effect on your bones. Well, by studying modern populations and the work that we do and the things that we do because of that, and also studying historic and ancient populations and knowing the lifestyle that they live based on other information, we can say we expect to see this in their bone morphology. So if we just find a set of human remains out of the desert somewhere, we probably get some information about what they did just by studying what the bones look like, if there were any breakages, things like that. That's another thing. Like I just did a study, a quick podcast on Ötzi the Iceman that was found. You know, everybody seems to know about Ötzi the Iceman. He was found in a glacier between England and Italy and was it Italy and Hungary, I think, or something. No, Italy and
yeah. How far back does he date to?
Oh, he was. What was it? 6,000-7,000 years. I mean, it was a long or 4,000 years, I think. It was a long time ago. But it was. They could tell a lot about him because he had some wounds that healed. So you can see the healing on the bones. So they knew that he had some broken bones and some wounds from, they don't know how long ago, but they know they had time to fully heal. So, you know, it wasn't right away. That's not what killed him. Yeah. So they knew from looking at Ötzi the Iceman's bones that he had some earlier breaks and some earlier trauma to his bones that had time to heal. So that's not what killed him. But they did see some fractures, and I want to say there was a head trauma. They don't know what caused it, but there was a head trauma that didn't show signs of healing, which, you know, he could have fallen or something like that. It doesn't necessarily mean violence against him, but he did have a fragment of a stone point in him as well. So it looked like he was hit with an arrow. That also could have been in there for a while, but the point is they can look at that stuff and tell a lot about the person just by looking at their remains and their bones. Now, with Ötzi the Iceman, we actually had skin and things, too, because he was a mummy. He was found preserved in the ice. Most of the time, we just have bones. Some other things we can tell if we just find bones, we can tell with relative certainty, it's not perfect, whether or not they were male or female. Sometimes you can even tell if they're female, whether or not they had children. because sometimes that really affects the pelvic area bones, of course, in a very predictable way. You can often tell the age of a person. I think age is really difficult for once they're out of adolescence and then before they start getting really old. If it's anywhere in the middle, I think it's relatively difficult to tell age. Not impossible, but more difficult. They have to take a lot of other environmental factors into consideration. And then, like you said, Scott, I mean, teeth are amazing records of your environment and what you ate, because teeth are basically minerals. They build up over time based on what you eat and your environment and where you live. And those chemicals that you ingest are used to help build your teeth. And they can tell by studying the environment where you were. Like, they knew that Otzi the Iceman was actually from, I think it was 60 or 70 miles north of where he was found, where he spent most of his time. They could tell by cutting open his teeth and looking further back in the basically the history of the tooth, because it's like a tree, you know, it builds from the inside out and just layer upon layer. And if they go back, they can look further back in time to his childhood after his adult teeth came in. And they knew that he spent his childhood in a different place than where he spent the bulk of his adult life growing up. They could tell that just by studying the chemicals in his teeth. So, yeah, you can learn a lot from bones.
Right. And something about the ridges. If you still have ridges in your teeth, then you probably don't have coarse bread, or that can affect the minerals that get in your food, all those things.
Yeah, that's another thing we can tell prehistorically, too, is a lot of women had like, what do they call it? I think I call it like a shovel type depression in the backsides of the teeth, because a lot of times when you're dealing with curing leather and doing different things, you'll actually hold it in your mouth really tightly and stretch it out with your feet or your hands and then do something else with it. Well, that over time, doing that time and time again actually affects your teeth and it can create different impressions in your teeth. We do the same thing with stone tools and other things and pottery. We'll look at it on the micro level and look at wear patterns. And by looking at the wear patterns and how things were worn down, you can infer what did the wearing down and therefore infer activity based on that.
Getting back to America, I remember a hoax from the early 20th century. I think it was the Piltdown Man.
Yeah.
There was a skeleton. People thought it was this early hominid. Oh, a hominid in America. It's like Mormon anthropology. I don't know. It's in America.
Right.
It's not elsewhere. And it wasn't true. Have you ever encountered that, you or anyone you know, where people think they have something and you have to say, sir, I'm sorry, but this is not even close to what you think it is?
All the time. It's called the internet and Facebook. But first, let me clear something up. You were mixing up two different things, actually.
Piltdown Man. I do all the time.
Yeah. Piltdown Man, I want to say it was around 1918 time frame. I could be wrong on that, but it was around that time frame. And it was in England.
Okay.
Yeah, we're pretty sure. And it was actually a human skull, I believe, with like an orangutan or ape-like jaw. And it was definitely placed in the ground. Nobody's ever owned up to it, and they never figure out who did it. But it was just trying to establish England, because Africa was taking the spotlight and India was taking the spotlight on early human remains. And some people just wanted to establish the UK as like the start of humanity. And it was a very misguided way to do that. But also, there was an early, it's called the Early Man Site in California, that Louis Leakey, an early proponent of human evolution and early researcher in that, him and his wife Mary Leakey they discovered all the big finds in Africa in the span of about 30 or 40 years, where they spent most of the time doing research. But Louis Leakey was called over by some researchers from Southern California to check out this site that had similar tools that you find on really old sites in Africa. And they thought that maybe it could be an early man site. And he was really interested in it. He went back and forth to it a couple times. It's still called the early man site. but most researchers don't think that there were people here 200,000 years ago making those tools in this country. And there's a lot of reasons. That's a whole separate podcast, too. But I do get, especially because of my affiliation with the Archaeology Podcast Network, and then I moderate a bunch of groups on Facebook for archaeology, you get people coming in every once in a while that say, look, I found this rock, or I found this thing, and it looks like this. And so it must be cultural. It must be human related. How could they possibly have done this? What could this possibly be? And you always have to, debunk that kind of stuff. Or, you know, maybe sometimes it's real, but a lot of times people have something and they think it's something and it's not. And that's a common trick of the mind that our brains like to play. It's called pareidolia. When you like the face on Mars,
Know,
it was from a grainy satellite shot and it looked like a face. But when they got up close to it and took a high res shot, it's actually just a pile of dirt. And like, you know, you see a unicorn in the clouds. That's called pareidolia. There isn't actually a cloud unicorn up there. But people see that stuff. Archaeologists do it all the time. If we're on a site, if we're on a, like a, God, I have to stop myself from doing it. If I'm on a site and I, and we have definite artifacts, everything around, like there's fragments of arrowheads or projectile points, we call them spear points, things like that. And then the debitage, which is just the stone flakes from making all that stuff everywhere. There's also other rocks that can be used as like hammer stones. So you use denser rocks to bang into the other rocks to create these flakes. And these hammer stones, they have a very specific wear patterns on them that you look for. And those could be on site. But then you also have other rocks that can be used as like grinding stones on slabs to grind like wheat and, you know, and other things into flour. When you get on a site that's prehistoric, you start looking at these other roundish rocks and say, well, that looks like it would fit in my hand really well. That must be cultural. That must be something. But you have to take your brain out of it, put science back into it and say, okay, are there wear patterns on this? Are there any signs that say, other than the fact that this fits in my hand really well and looks like it would work, is there any other evidence that points to it being something? And sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. And sometimes, I mean, Native Americans are also humans. And if I'm a Native American working 6,000 years ago, and I'm going to pick up a rock to make, to flint nap or make other projectile points or grind, I'm going to find a rock that actually does fit well in my hand. Probably, you know, I'm not going to pick up that weirdly shaped one over there. I'm going to pick up something that's comfortable because I'm going to be working with this for the rest of the day. So it does make sense to pick stuff up and say, this looks like it should be cultural, but you have to back that up with evidence. You have to back that up with other lines of evidence that point to it being cultural. And that's the thing that the general public typically doesn't do. They typically stop at, this looks like an artifact. It must be. And then they bring it to us and we're like, I don't know. We need more pictures.
Do you have any favorite false positives of something that someone brought to you?
There's a guy who continuously emails me. He's down in the Caribbean somewhere. I think he's in the Bahamas or something. He's a local down there. And he has found this series of rocks that he just insists are something. I don't even know what he thinks they are. And it's just like he sees like faces and patterns in them. He's trolling them around all the different sites on Facebook and trying to get archaeologists to acknowledge that they're something. And I've never told him that they're not something, but I haven't told him that I can't see that there's evidence that they are something. I mean, they look like rocks that could be something. They don't look relatively natural, so to speak. They definitely look odd. But when you travel around this world, you realize that nature can make a lot of really odd things. And sometimes it can make a lot of really odd one-off things that are just a product of natural processes, but our brain just won't accept that. Like it's not similar to anything we've ever seen. And we have to, I mean, he just emailed me like a couple weeks ago with something again, like another thing from his collection or something he found locally that it's gotta be crazy. It's gotta be something like, what is this? What could it possibly be? I was like, I don't know, dude. I couldn't tell you.
I wonder if why archaeology seems to attract some, how should we say, interesting people. The ancient astronaut theory, that guy on the History Channel with the crazy hair with the pyramids and aliens. And is it because of, by its very nature, it's unknown and we don't have written records with, let us say prehistoric that, I don't know, people's imaginations can run wild.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's, first off, people are fascinated with history, whether they admit it or not. People are fascinated with history in any, in certain shapes or forms. Like whether or not you care about archaeology or Native Americans or even, you know, Mesopotamians or Egyptians, you care about your own family, typically, like your own family history. And that's still caring about history. It's just more recent. So everybody has a fascination with the past in some way or another. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, people also have a fascination with our origins. Where did we come from? Where did we, you know, how did we get here? And science fiction has told us that aliens are a possibility. And as a scientist, I'm not even going to say that's impossible. I'm just going to say it's highly improbable and it's highly unlikely. The probability is not zero that aliens have been to this planet and that they've influenced our culture in some way. That's not zero, but it's shockingly close to zero. just because of the technology it would take to get here. And, you know, there would be other evidence, you would think. They wouldn't clear up their tracks that well. I mean, I just feel like, you know, you look at any, I mean, you have to think too, that if we were visited by aliens, like any other society, it was probably a government ship, right? So this is a government ship of aliens. It's probably military. They're on their way out here. They're just doing a survey. They're figuring stuff out. They find this planet with a bunch of primitives on it. they're going to screw something up. I mean, our own governments, it can't cover their tracks very well. I can't imagine an alien government would be any better at it. So they would leave some other evidence other than some weirdly shaped rock or, you know, some other weird thing. And I just think people have, it's also a little bit of racism going on. People have a really hard time believing that a quote primitive race, or so they think, could actually construct what they did. You look at the pyramid, that's an easy example, but we have a lot of that in the United States as well with the mound builder societies of like Ohio and the surrounding states in Ohio there. You have all these fantastic mound structures like Cahokia in Arizona and Serpent Mound and all these other things that it took months, if not years in some cases, and thousands of people to construct these, but they did it. It wasn't aliens. Aliens wouldn't come here and pile up a bunch of dirt. I mean, it's just not... that's just not in the realm of possibility. I think it's ignorance first off that causes people to think that way. But then it's a fascination for history, and they want to answer the question. Everybody's a little bit of a detective. They don't like having questions unanswered, but they don't have the background in science and the background in history to answer the question appropriately. So they come up with whatever society has provided them, and for a lot of people, that's aliens or other fantastic, theories that just, simply aren't true.
And I love the chutzpah of, I don't have a plausible explanation on hand, so I'm immediately going to go to aliens.
rather than
something else that's a little bit closer and a little more plausible. No, aliens.
Right. It's always aliens.
Well, I guess to reflect on the work you do and archaeology in general and tie a lot of these things in, are there any things that you wanted to preserve, but you weren't able to, whether funding reasons or whatever other reason that you wish you could have?
Yeah, all the time, actually. And most of the reason for that is the nature of our work. So I'll give you a small example. I did a really small project over the summer at a mine over near Elko, Nevada. And we found some pretty cool sites, but the nature of our work is, at our level. So we go out there, we do the survey. We record the sites, we make our recommendations. Now, in this particular case, as in most of Nevada, the land is actually owned by the federal government. It's BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land, or a lot of times it's U.S. Forest Service land as well. So one of those two things, like something, somewhere around 90% of the land in Nevada, I've heard, is owned by the federal government in one way or another. Now, mines and ranchers and things like that, they come in and lease this land. So the typical order of operations is we'll come in, do a survey, we'll record sites to the best of our ability. We'll make recommendations if any of those are recommended as potentially eligible, which is usually all we can do for listing on the National Register of Historic Places, like we talked about. That goes to the agency. That goes to the State Historic Preservation Officer, and they'll make a final determination. They'll counter our determination. They'll do something. But usually, once we submit that report with our findings, it's out of our hands. We almost never get the opportunity to come back in and fight for a property, unless we do it on our own time, unless we do it, outside the realm of our company or whoever we're working for. If we go to the agency and we say, listen, I want to start filing the paperwork to list this on the National Register of Historic Places and preserve it, then it's simply not going to get done. Somebody has to take care with that property and take it over and say, listen, I want this to be my personal responsibility, and I'm going to get this listed on the National Register. But the problem is most people don't do that unless it's personally important to them. It's all the time. I have found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sites I'd like to see preserved. But the reality is probably none of them were, because they're all open pit mines now, or they're highways, or they're something else. And, there either wasn't the money or there wasn't the inclination from anyone. It wasn't important to anyone enough to go in and say, I want to preserve this.
Do you have anything that sticks out in your mind as the one that got away?
I would say one that does stick out a lot, and I think about it a lot, is this old mining town that we found in central Nevada. It was an actual town. Like, there weren't any buildings left, but you could see the streets. There were a lot of artifacts there. You could see the structure of the town. You could see all this. I would like to have seen that preserved and possibly reconstructed. There are some reconstructed mining towns here in Nevada where there were some buildings left and they went and built more buildings in the style of the old ones. So you can go there and tour around these old towns, because it's a really good slice of history to see how these people lived in literally the middle of nowhere. The one I'm thinking about would have been several days probably by horse or wagon from Reno, which would have been the closest big city. And I mean, it's in a really rough area. We were over there, we were recording it during the summertime, and it was, did I cut out?
No, I could still hear
Okay,
you.
I thought I heard something. Anyway, we were over there during the summertime, and it was hot, it was miserable, it was crazy. And you're thinking about people 120 years ago in like wool clothing and trying to go into these mines and dig out this stuff and do this work and live in this society. And then in the wintertime, it's completely the opposite. You know, it's below zero and there's 10 feet of snow on the ground. They're just trying to figure it out. And it was amazing to me. And I know for a fact that that site has been destroyed. I've flown over it. I'm in the Civil Air Patrol, and we fly over that way a lot. And I've flown over it, and it's now it, there was an open there was a really big open mine right next to it, and they were expanding their property, and they basically just expanded out once we were done because, quite frankly, we said it was probably potentially eligible for listing, but somebody made a determination that it wasn't, and nobody fought for it, and so now it's a hole in the ground, and it's gone forever. So, but I do feel good in the fact that we spent probably 4 or 5 days recording that. We took a ton of pictures, wrote a lot of pages of description, and I think we did our due diligence in recording that site to the best of our ability. So it's not gone forever in that sense, but it is gone in a real sense that it's, you know, it's now destroyed. But that's what we do, and that's one of the things that we have to do as our job, is we have to just basically record stuff to the best of our ability, assuming that it's going to be destroyed. Not always, but assuming that it probably is. And that's our job. And that's kind of the hard part about being a serum archaeologist, especially in the West.
Well, if not for that, it would have been completely gone. So kudos for you for at least getting that much in. And
Right.
for people who want to learn more about all the things you do a lot of podcasting and work with a lot of different people.
Yeah.
So my head was spinning when we met each other at the Podcast Movement Conference and talking about all the things you do, because I just have one show. So can you describe just a bit of the different shows you have and where the best place is for people to find you online?
Sure. The best place is really archpodnet.com. It's archpodnet.com. Archaeologypodcastnetwork.com works as well. And if you type in archaeology podcast into like a search engine, we're just about the only thing that shows up. There are some older shows that aren't going anymore from other groups that show up, but that's mostly our shows. So we have currently, I want to say, 19 podcasts now. I host or co-host 6 or 7 of them. I lost track of it. And but we have everything from my original show, which is the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and that's really for CRM professionals. We don't define anything. We don't, you know, it's not for the general public. You can listen to it. I mean, you can find it on iTunes or wherever, but it's really an industry-specific podcast. We've got a set number of listeners. I don't expect that to ever grow, really, because it's all professionals. But feel free to go over there if you're interested in this field and you want to learn more about it. We focus a lot on education for, you know, students and people new in the field and stuff like that. So you can still learn some stuff. We also have we have a lot of shows, a number of shows actually, that are really just kind of fun to listen to. There's one produced in the UK called Prehistories, and it's a woman over there named Kim Bidolf, and she basically brings on archaeologists and experts and sometimes the authors of books that are about times in the historic past. So a good example of what she did is Clan of the Cave Bear. And they talked about that book, but they brought on people who are experts in that time period to talk about kind of like what did the book get right and what did it get wrong and stuff like that. And it's really interesting. Speaking of ancient aliens, we have one that's one of our most popular shows called Archaeological Fantasies. And that is hosted by Sarah Head, who's done a lot of work on her blog about debunking different pseudo-archaeological topics. But her co-hosts are Dr. Kenneth Fader and Dr. Jeb Card. And they have both written extensively in books and publications and research on different pseudo-archaeological stuff. So a lot of stuff people believe that just isn't real, they get behind the real story, and they bring on really great guests to talk about some of these things and sort of a debunking of some of that stuff. But just not just a debunking, but really getting into the real science behind this stuff and what is the reality behind what people are talking about. And a couple others. I've got the Archaeology Show, which is a show that is a general topics in archaeology, but definitely geared towards general public. We do unpack definitions. We try to stay away from jargon and terminology, and we want the it's a it's a public education podcast. We'll bring on a lot of different people, talk about different things, and try to pull back the veil on some of the news items that are out there. And there's a bunch of other shows. We got a daily one called Arc 365. If you just need your 3 to 5 minute daily fix of something archaeological, some site, go check that out. And like I said, it's every single day of the year in 2017, and we're really close to possibly doing that in 2018 as well. So we'll see. My intention was to just do it for 1 year. But if I can get some help with it, we might get it going through 2018 as well. So, but yeah, feel free to check it out. Arcpodnet.com. We're also on Google, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Definitely enough archaeological content to keep people busy for a really long time. So
absolutely. We'll include. Oh, and one other thing real quick, something we just started doing is a show called You Call This Archaeology. And it's a line from one of the Indiana Jones shows, but it's basically myself and my colleague, who's an archaeologist here. We just talk about kind of our last week and what we did. And so a lot of people think archaeology is all adventure and, like I said, whips and guns and sometimes dinosaurs, but sometimes it's just sitting down in a library and doing research. Sometimes it's writing a report. Sometimes it's, you know, talking to clients. Sometimes it's other stuff. And we basically just talk about our week and what we did. And right now I don't have that up on iTunes yet, but on our Archaeology Podcast Network Facebook page, we were going live. It was a live recording on Facebook Live at 3 p.m. on Fridays. But now it's, because we have a work schedule change, now it's going to be 4 p.m. on Saturdays. So check that out at the APN Facebook page if you want to see us live and talking about archaeology. And all our past shows, we've done 15 shows, I think. They're all on there as well. And you can go back and watch those if you want. So we've been figuring out the Facebook Live thing. So the video and audio is sketchy in most of them, but we're getting better with it every time.
I've tried that too. And when it doesn't sync up, it's like a Clint Eastwood spaghetti Western Sergio Leone film.
Yeah, it's terrible.
But it works out. So, and people can comment as you're going. And that's well, right. Yeah. And I'll include links to everything you mentioned there. A lot for people to dive into, but Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Scott. This was fun.
Well, that was the interview with Chris. You can check out all of the different websites that he mentioned in the show notes for this episode. Go to historyunplugpodcast.com. Two other things. If you would like to submit a question to me that I can review on the in-between-isodes that appear Tuesday through Friday for this podcast, you can also go to historyunplugpodcast.com or send an email to info@historyonthenet.com and I'll answer anything that you throw at me. If you would like to help out this show, one of the biggest things that you can do is leave a review on iTunes. Helps gives us exposure, it puts us on different podcast lists, and it's a huge help. You can go to that same site that I just mentioned twice, and I'll have instructions on how you can leave a review. If you can do that, I would really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history-related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.